Hello and welcome. My guest today is Dickie Busch, the writer and entrepreneur who just 9 months ago left his job to go full-time on writing online and teaching others how to do the same. Dickie is a recurring guest for this podcast. He was episode 21 and 110, and this conversation was a cool check-in with Dickie, who is an incredibly wise, thoughtful, interesting, and insightful human being. In this conversation, we spoke about finding a wife, writing a book, journaling, long-term thinking, why fitness YouTubers have inspired him, his framework for creating content online, and much more. And so you're really in for a treat with this one if you're interested in writing, online business creation, or becoming the best version of yourself. Before we get into the episode, please do me a favor. Share it, tweet it, make it your Instagram story, text it to a friend who is interested in one of those topics as well, because I know we all have one of those friends who's interested in these things. So do me a favor, share this episode right now, or get to the end of the episode. If you make it to the end of the episode, then share the episode. So the more this show grows, the better the guests we can have on. The better guests we have on, the more the show grows. It's a beautiful cycle. So share this episode. That would make me very happy indeed. And now, here's a little bit of what to expect with this episode with Dickie Busch.
What if everyone on Earth did everything they said they were going to do? Right? Because all at the end of the day, you're either doing the things you said you're going to do or you're not. And if you just did the things that you know you should be doing, like there's a $1 trillion personal growth and self-help industry basically telling people, if you just do the things you say you're going to do, you'll probably end up in a good spot.
Dickie, welcome to the podcast.
What's going on? Been what, a year now? A year since the last one? Something, or it might have been earlier.
Episode 21 and episode 110 of this podcast.
And what are we on now?
300 something. And we're back. So let me do a little brief intro so people can get a feel for the journey since you've outlined this before. Dickie Busch studied math and played football at Princeton, graduated in 2018. Worked for BlackRock, started to write on a blog and Twitter, started a 30-day writing challenge, which turned into Ship 30 for 30, scaled it to, at one point, over 2,000 students, and now 5,600, I believe, and then left BlackRock and, yeah, appeared on episode 21 and episode 110 of this podcast. That's like the last two are really the most important parts of the journey.
I need to add that to my bio. Was on episode 21 of the... But seriously, when you're on episode 1,000 and this is... millions of listeners, it's going to be cool to look back on that. That was October 2020, I think we filmed it, and then it was released, what, November?
Yes, that sounds right. And it's been a wild ride, man. And we'll get into all of it.
Yeah, wow.
And I'm excited to, but break down for me how it felt to be walking along the Miami Boulevard yesterday, and you hear a, Dickie! You're walking shirtless in the middle of Miami, and across the road, you hear that. What's going through your head?
Well, the context is, it was what, 1 p.m., maybe noon yesterday, and I was out listening to a couple podcasts, just taking a walk, soaking in some vitamin D, shirtless, kind of in the, just soaking it in, enjoying the Miami sun. And I hear a, Dickie! My first thing that goes through my head is like, kind of uh-oh. Right? I don't know who that is. I got to go check it out. But it's just so funny to see you there because I knew we were talking yesterday. Mm-hmm. But it's fun. And that's starting to happen a little bit more. And it's kind of interesting. Right? And I'm sure you're feeling the same way of having video on there. You become completely different from just writing, which is what I've done for the most part. But then when people can actually put a face to your name, you develop a deeper relationship and become more recognizable, which has its ups, pros and cons for sure. But
what's been your experience like of being recognized in public? This is something when we were doing episode 21, it wasn't fathomable,
really to be like, oh, people will come up to us at some point.
Yeah. I don't know. It does not happen very often. Like, I'm still not famous by any means, right? And so it's actually just every time it happens, I try to sit back and reflect on, wow, I've come a long way since that episode 21, right? Where I think I had 800 Twitter followers at the time. And I remember when you reached out, I thought it was the coolest thing ever because you had like 15,000. I was like, oh my goodness, this guy wants to interview me? Like, is this the wrong account? You know, how did he reach out? But that's just how this goes, is you end up meeting people along the way. And it's definitely been an interesting journey.
And now you have, I believe, 300,000 followers on Twitter, which is just a wild amount. And I've got 30,000. So I've doubled in that time and you've 100x'd. And when I was listening to you on previous podcasts, you've said this happens to you all the time whenever you entered into a new game. What would happen is you would go through and do whatever you do, deconstruct the game better than everyone else, and pass the people who, when you started, you almost looked up to. Mm-hmm. And how oftentimes that would get people upset of like, how is that person passing me or whatever? I'm personally very happy for you and excited for your growth, and it inspires me, not that I want to bring
you back. I know what you're saying.
And so it's interesting to point out that that has happened to you in your other obsessions as well.
Yeah, I can't remember which part. Was that with Greg or... I can't remember who it was with, but that's definitely been a trait throughout my life. And I wrote about this a little bit of growing up, I'd latch on to obsessions, whether that was the Tampa Bay Rays when I was really young, or I was a professional speed cuber in fifth grade and played professional Call of Duty in seventh grade. And the common thread is, I was reflecting actually at the end of this year, I went to Sedona, Arizona, spent a week off the grid and kind of just thought through the last 2 or 3 years and the last 5 really since I graduated, and then started to reflect a little bit longer. And one of those big takeaways was that I have an obsessive personality, and it's obvious, sounds so obvious to say given the different things I've done, but I never sat back and kind of journaled and reflected on what that means. And growing up, it 100% felt like a bug in my personality. And I think society and schools and parents, and not my parents, but other parents or other people, they look at someone who brings a level of obsession or intensity to something, and it can be kind of off-putting. And what the internet has allowed me to realize is that that was not a bug, it was a feature. And now I've been able to find other people who have that kind of intense personality and latch onto things and like to do them well. But I would do anything to go back to being that fifth grader or seventh grader and find the other people who were interested in that, because I think I spent a lot of my time growing up thinking, what am I doing wrong? Because like you said, my friends would start something, I'd kind of be late to the party, and then I'd pick it up and I'd take it far more seriously than they would. And then it would be like I had to find new friends almost to play that game with. And that cycle repeated for, you know, a lot of the things I've done. But what's been so great about writing on the internet was I could talk about those things and immediately I would attract other people who are also interested in it. So the framework I love for this is that the internet's democratized access to friendship, meaning the fifth grader, the seventh grader now interested in whatever it is they want to obsess over, they can go find other people in it, so they don't feel like I'm the only one in my town. And for the most part, they probably are the only ones in their town or the only ones in their neighborhood. But yeah, it has been a positive realization to think about, but also recognizing the potential downsides of having that, where if you direct that obsessive personality at the wrong game, I'm a very much liquid takes the shape of its container, right? And I can go in a far other direction. So it's always a balancing act of kind of pointing that obsession in the right place.
Yeah. I mean, I really resonate with that, and especially being that seventh grader who was writing on the internet and then saying to myself, I don't want to do this because I want to be a normal kid. So like, do you still subscribe? By normal kid, I was just like, I didn't want 40-year-old women writing about me saying that I must not actually be 13 years old. I must be someone else. And I must be someone pretending to be a 13-year-old. And so I guess my question to you is, like, do you think that 13-year-olds should be writing online? And then, like, at what age do you think is appropriate or right to, like, start putting your ideas out there, if you think there is a start and end for that?
I don't think there's a perfect start. What I do think is parents, and where I'm extremely grateful for mine, is that they let me lean into those obsessions my entire life. Yeah. I was never limited on the amount of video games I could play or the number of times I could bring my Rubik's Cube to whatever it is I was doing. And I'd look at all my other friends and it was like they couldn't play video games on weekdays, or they couldn't do these, like, their parents didn't allow them to ever chase an obsession instead said they needed to be quote unquote well-rounded
or normal.
Right. And I think that's a lot of parents project what they were taught about the world onto their children versus, I can't wait to let my kids eventually chase their obsession, and then my obsession becomes whatever they're obsessed with. Like, I can't remember where I heard this, but it's there's a popular VC or so, I don't know who it was, but his son decided that he was going to be a Seattle Seahawks fan, and they're from, you know, Texas, somewhere not anywhere related. And a lot of parents would be like, no, why, you know, we want to like the Texans or we want to like this team. And the dad said, no. I'm now a Seattle Seahawks super fan. I'm going to go learn everything about their history. We're going to go to their games. I'm going to read the books. Like, if you want to like this thing, I want to like this thing. And I think that's the coolest way to let your children obsess over things. So where that comes with writing, I don't know if there's necessarily a connection other than you could encourage them to participate and just learn. There's no better way to learn things than to write about them. And so if you can pair that obsession with, hey, what can we learn from this? I think that's kind of an interesting thread to pull on.
You speak a lot about raising children and being a father in the future, but to my knowledge, you don't have a wife or you don't have a partner where you're going to have kids with yet. Mm. So I'm curious, how does Dickie Bush go about finding a wife or find someone to raise children with?
That's a great question. I think that right now, I know that the path I want to take is in the next 10 years to be a father. I think it's a cool lens to think about. Everything I'm doing now is to build the foundation to be a world-class dad in the future. And sequencing that out, I think, brings me to my current focuses, which are building a foundation of health and a foundation of finances, where those long-term fatherly goals are just a byproduct, right? If I focus now on getting myself in physical shape that is going to last a lifetime and building a financial foundation that I can build on for a lifetime, I think the relationships, the different opportunities are just byproducts of time passing by with that foundation built. And so it's helpful to me to have some kind of long-term lens of how am I connecting what I'm doing today to 10, 15, 20 years in the future. And that's been the one that's worked the best for me and came from some reflection on why am I doing any of these things I'm doing. And I think it's not an easy reflection question to have of why am I, it's the existential kind of thing that, like, a lot of people avoid wanting to reflect on. So I tried to find some kind of connection where I can say, I'm doing this because that leads to that, which leads to that, which helps me be a better father in the future. So just kind of the way I sequence things out.
Yeah, well, that is a nice answer, and it's all about you. But I'm curious about the woman. What type of woman do you find yourself thinking about and being like, all right, this is the type of woman I could see myself raising children with?
Honestly, have not done enough thinking or reflecting on it. I think someone who is interested in having a big family built on strong values and I really haven't done enough thinking on that.
And I find myself in this same position where it's like, I know I want to be a great dad someday, but if I haven't set out and be like, this is the woman who, these are the values I want her to have. This is the type of person. This is her family upbringing. How am I actually going to find that person if I don't know what I'm looking for?
Yeah. And that's a great point. And I think for now, I've recognized that I'm not in the position where that is a priority. And so when it becomes a priority, that would be the type of exercise I would do.
How do you know when it becomes a priority?
That's the ultimate question, right? Is if you end up waiting too long. But for me, I kind of look at it like, hey, I'm 26 years old, right? If I'm 35 and that's when I think about having kids, like, I mean, my dad, I come from an older family. So my dad is 70 and my mom is, I won't say her age, but she's close to that age. Sorry, mom, if you're listening to this. It's the 30th anniversary of her 30th birthday. But so I think I'm predisposed to having children later. So I think it's not any time in the near future, but it's just nice to think about extending the horizon and saying, if I wait till I'm 35, more than likely I'll do that kind of thinking along the way.
Yeah, that makes sense. And, you know, I was talking to George Heaton about this, who is somebody who is striving to be the best version of himself. He's putting his head down in business, putting his head down in fitness. And what ends up happening because of that, and I feel like I'm trying to be in that same boat, is like the pool of potential women lessens as you get better. Because in a way, because you're like, well, if I'm increasing the standards for myself, then I'm going to also increase the standards for the person I want to be with. And there are less people who fit those standards.
That's interesting. And this is making me think where I'm at right now. I think the dream person that I would build a family with is actually not attracted to the version of myself right now. Like if I continue to improve and level up, that means that the person I ultimately end up attracting has leveled up as well. Mm. Right. So it's like, if you're relentlessly focused on improving yourself, then that pool does get smaller. And I think that's kind of the goal, right? Is where you're operating from a better potential.
Yeah. I like that. And so three of the character traits that you want to embody this year are relentlessness, thoughtfulness, and accountability. And so I'd like to break these down. What does relentlessness mean to you?
So this exercise came from during my end of year reflection. I started to think about what are some terms that if someone was describing me to a friend, I'd like them to use. And I liked that exercise because it was a way of how am I living that people can recognize in my behaviors a certain theme. And I had like 10 of them. And I was trying to remember them on a run one day. And I was like, I can't remember all 10. And I spent multiple hours trying to come up with this list. And I came back the next day and said, clearly 10 is too many. How can I add some constraint that makes this easier to remember? Because to embody those character traits, I have to keep them top of mind. And so that essay you're referencing, I have three questions that go with that of how do I become relentless? Well, I need to ask myself, what would a relentless person do? How do I become thoughtful? I have to always think, how can I take an action that a thoughtful person would do? And same with accountability. So relentlessness, I think, is a way. I love Jeff Bezos' obsession with this, right?
Relentless.com.
Relentless.com redirects to Amazon. And a lot of people don't know his other name for Amazon was going to be relentless.com, which is so interesting that it started that way, right? Totally unrelated. But to me, relentlessness is just a way of bringing energy, intensity, efficiency, focus. Those four I just mentioned were character traits along with relentless. And so as I was trying to bucket them, I was like, how could I reduce this 10 down to 3? And relentless, what does a relentless person do? They're efficient. They're energetic. They're optimistic, right? And so that was the first one I said, well, it looks like this one encompasses all of these. And so I can say, what would a relentless person do? Well, they're efficient. They're energetic. They're right. And so it simplified it for me. And now I can go around and spend my time with just those three top of mind.
Do you have a model? Like Jeff Bezos is a great example of somebody who is relentless, but do you have other models for people who embody those attributes as well?
Not a model as much as I can recognize. I think having both a gamer background, a athletic background, and I just love greatness. So I can, if there's bowling on and it's the best bowlers in the world, like I could watch that for hours, right? Because the game that they decided to play might be different than games I've played, but how they achieved it is probably through the same cherishing of the monotonous work, right? Showing up every, all those kind of things that I think a relentless person does. And so I don't have a perfect model, but I can recognize it right away.
What does thoughtful mean to you?
So this one's twofold. And it's both in how I interact with other people and how I solve problems. So I think a thoughtful person, right? The good lens for this is the shopping cart test. I don't know if you've heard about this one, but it's a great test for how you are as a person is if you put your shopping cart back. And as I was in a parking lot one day with a shopping cart, and I was like, why in my head am I going to put this back? Like, what is the lens of who I am that's like dictating this versus just leaving this here? And I used that as, well, a good lens for that is, well, the thoughtful person would return this. The thoughtful person would do X, Y, and Z, right? The thoughtful person, when they show up to someone else's house, like brings it. There's tons of examples, but it's an all-encompassing lens of when I'm treating someone else, how can I have a thoughtful action? How can I be thoughtful with that? But then I also heard James Clear on his episode with Tim Ferriss say he likes to solve problems with what would a thoughtful approach to this be, which means just putting more thought behind things. And so now as I'm going about, you know, either trying to grow the business or trying to solve any problem in my life, I'm like, okay, well, what is a thoughtful approach to doing that? And that's been helpful as well.
It's interesting because when I think of James Clear, the first thing that comes to mind is thoughtful. Mm. And when I think of you, it is also thoughtful before you even posted this. And I think there's something very attractive about thoughtful people in general. Why are we so attracted to those who give thought?
So many people live life on autopilot in non-thoughtful ways, which are just following a script. Or thoughtfulness, I think, requires presence. You have to be present in the moment to understand what a thoughtful approach to this would be. So it's a lot easier said than done. Like, I'd love to sit here and say that I make every decision through a thoughtful lens, but the truth is I'm on robot mode like a lot of the time. But I think we're attracted to them because it shows that they're slightly different than how most people operate, right? If you have a thoughtful approach to solving a problem, people recognize that was unconventional, right? If you have a thoughtful way of remembering people's names or whatever it is you do that you consider thoughtful when engaging with other people, they're going to remember and recognize that.
Can you break down your system for remembering names? Because I've since used this since your push.
Yeah, that one is easy. And it goes back to, I think for a long time, I told myself I was horrible with names. And I realized I was kind of just lazy. And I think a lot of people might have that character trait of I'm poor with names, but have you ever tried to be good with names? And so now anytime I meet pretty much anyone, I just put it in I mean, there's like 200 names in here. And I don't, for any other reason other than the second I write it down, I can connect a face to a name and I see visually that note of like blank at blank, Nick at Panther, Julie at wherever. And then the power of remembering someone's name on a follow-up when they don't expect you to, I think is one of the coolest experiences you can have when it's a service worker or it's someone at the coffee shop or whatever it is, when they have no expectation for you to remember their name and then you do, it's instant. Like, this person is thoughtful. They were empathetic and they listened to me, because think about how many times they've told someone their name and then they don't remember it. They come back. It's like, I don't remember who you are. I was going about my day and you happened to be in the way and I got your name, but whatever. So I think it's a low effort, extremely high impact way to be more thoughtful.
It reminds me of Bill Clinton putting and creating note cards for every person that he would meet. He didn't have a phone to write down the names. He just had the tools available to him. And you're just doing what he did back in the day, which probably accounted for a lot of votes. People who he met on a second time said their name and they were like, how did he remember that?
Yeah, I can't remember where I read his system, but he had something absurd where apparently he was the best person with names in ever. Right? Everyone said it was like when you met Bill Clinton, he was like your best friend. Mm-hmm. And I think there's that thoughtfulness in action, right? If a thoughtful person, it feels like you're the only person they're talking to when you're talking to them.
Presence.
Right? Mm-hmm.
So how do you build the presence muscle?
If anyone listening has good advice on this, please send it my way. Because the truth is, I don't have a good framework for it. I think I've meditated on and off for a long time, and I'm back on it this year. I think I'm at like 20 days in a row.
Really?
20 days in a row, because I said, how am I going to remember this? I stacked it onto a habit I was already doing. Now I'm tracking it. The whole kind of regular playbook for it. And have I noticed any real difference? Not quite. But I think that compounds, where if I can stick to this for like a year, that's probably the longest I ever meditated in a row. It was like 2018, 2019. And I return to that period in my life a good bit as I think about all the things I was doing that set the foundation for me to start writing, to start sharing those ideas, just obsessive reading and podcasting and general self-improvement during that time. And so I do think back to those, what was I doing there, that everything that's happened to me over the last 2 years, I sowed the seeds of in those 2018, 2019 years, that now I'm thinking, what am I sowing the seeds of in the future with what I'm doing today?
It's so fascinating that you're 20 days into your meditation streak. I'm 10 days into, I said I was going to do 100 days of meditation. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why we both came to the same conclusion at the same time. I didn't read your tweet to make that happen, but just in sync, because I just realized, oh, this is an area where that's worked in the past. And you've mentioned before, well, meditation there wasn't the metrics to back it up. And so when you're such a metrics-driven person, it's sometimes hard to go based on feel and based on, well, I was kind of feeling better at this time, but you don't really know why, and you can't really associate it with anything. So talk to me about your experience of doing things based on feel when you are such a data-driven person.
Again, I hope listeners or watchers have advice for me on this, because that is 100% an area I struggle, where I stopped meditating because there was no tangible. So what I was actually started to do was HRV breath training. And HRV breath training, I was able to track the improvement on my whoop. So I called it quantitative meditation. I'm not wearing it right now, but it was like quantitative meditation, because I was seeing the progress. But I am trying to find more areas of my life that I go off of feel, because I don't know, it's something in the Myers-Briggs. There's like thinkers and feelers or something like that. Mm. I'm 100% on the opposite side of feeling. I'm very, here's what is happening, here's the path, here's what needs to be done, you know. So don't have perfect advice there, but trying just to find small things like meditation where I know I'm just going off feel.
Is there anything else?
Not right now.
Okay. It's fair.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then the last one is accountable that we spoke about.
Yeah. So relentless, thoughtful, accountable. And accountable is upholding a standard. Hmm. Where I want to define some standards, and I haven't done this yet. But to me, accountable, what does an accountable person do? They're accountable to themselves. They're accountable to others. What are they accountable to? It's a standard. You know, the way they treat others, the way they conduct their lives, the way they take care of themselves, all of those different things that you can uphold and be accountable to. It felt like that was a perfect character trait where now I can say, well, an accountable person does what they say they're going to do. They're on time. They're organized. They're diligent. They're intentional. All those other things that were on that long list of 10 fell into an identity of an accountable person. And so that's how I settled on that one.
So for relentless, I have Jeff Bezos in my head. For thoughtful, I have James Clear. For accountable, I have trouble figuring or thinking about a person who is accountable. Do any come to mind for you?
I draw a lot of inspiration actually from fitness YouTubers.
I'm so happy you brought that up.
And we can talk a lot on where that role played, but Nick Baer is someone, I know he's been on this podcast, right?
Yes.
And Nick's someone I look up to because he strikes me as an unaccountable person, right? Sets a standard, operates to that standard, sticks with it. And so I look up to him in a big way of running a business, having a family, being a hybrid athlete, doing those kind of things. So that to me is an accountable person, because at the highest level, an accountable person does the things they say they're going to do, right? I love this idea of what if everyone on earth did everything they said they were going to do, right? Because at the end of the day, you're either doing the things you said you're going to do or you're not. And if you just did the things that you know you should be doing, like there's a $1 trillion personal growth and self-help industry basically telling people, if you just do the things you say you're going to do, you'll probably end up in a good spot. But people want to overcomplicate it. And so if I was writing a self-help book, it'd be do the things that you know you should be doing and put the book down. Right?
I have a question here about if you wrote a book, what would it be on?
I thought about this one. I think Cole and I might write a book on building a daily writing habit and co-author that together, which I think would be kind of cool. But I haven't thought too much about the book side. But if I was going to write a pure self-help book, it would be, 10 pages long and say 10 pages that cut through the 300,000 other books. And here are the 10 one sentence principles, and try to distill all of self-help down to like 10 things, which I think would be kind of cool.
That would be awesome.
Right? Instead of expanding it, just make it paper thin and be like, here it is. Here's everything. Put your other books back.
When everyone's writing these 300 page books, you stand out by either writing a 3,000 page book or writing a three page or 10 page book.
Yeah. I mean, the truth is most of those books probably should be 10 pages, but the author signed a book deal, right? Which is why I love the power of internet writing, where you're rewarded for conciseness and clarity rather than, hey, I had a book, I expanded that book to 300 pages to hit a word count so I could get this advance. You're just recognize the incentives of what you're reading for the most part are not aligned with the reader.
It's a broken system, but you don't realize that when you're not writing and when you're not talking to authors on a daily basis, but you're just the one who's consuming it. It's not like you're sitting there like, what are the incentives of this person who is writing this book? It just doesn't cross your mind.
Yeah. And it's not anyone's fault, right? Yeah. When you're just, books are good, right? Yeah. We're taught books are good.
Yeah.
And I think they are. But you need to be very careful about why the reader wrote the book or why the writer wrote the book. That's the question you should ask with anything you're reading. What inspired this book? Is it so that they're now a published author? Because that is a far different book than they have a message that they need to get out. And the only way they could do that was to write the book, versus the people who are approached by these publishers saying, hey, we need you to write a book. How do I write that book? Well, you expand something that you've done that probably doesn't need to be expanded upon. And then, you're circling the same idea in 1,000 different ways.
By the same token, it makes me think that we should always be asking whenever we consume anything, what are the incentives of this person for creating this thing?
Yeah. I mean, it's cliche, but Charlie Munger says, show me the incentives and I'll show you the result.
Yeah.
Right. And so this is been a higher level framework for operating with other people for me, is I always assume other people are acting in their own best self-interest, right? Because when I do that, it forces me to align my incentives with theirs. So people can go, oh, that's not a very altruistic way to see the world, which I don't think There's very little true altruism in this world. I think it's mostly 99% people aligned, their action is aligned on some incentive. So if you accept that rather than kind of say, oh, I wish people were perfectly good and doing the best thing at all times, you force yourself to go, how can I present the things I need in a way that is helpful for that person too, right? Which kind of simplifies the world. If you never have faulty expectations for a person because you never expect them to act out of alignment to their best self-interest, and forces you to align yours with theirs.
Hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. I want to go back to the fitness YouTubers and particularly Nick Bear, but really any of them that you've enjoyed. Like, why do you think you went so deep into that rabbit hole? Because I've personally as well in the past, and I enjoy Christian Guzman, Max Tuning, Rob Lipsett, Joe Delaney, Mike Vacanti is how I got started on this whole thing. So it's very similar to you. Why do you think you were so attracted to fitness YouTubers in general, and who's really resonated with you other than Nick Bear?
Those guys you said, Christian Guzman, Max Tuning, a couple like Matt Ogus, OG guys, like old fitness YouTubers who are still in the game now. But for my personal fitness journey was I was 280 pounds 5 years ago. And so I had to find some kind of pseudo mentors who were doing things that were aligned with what I was looking to do, because the truth is there was no one else out there who was looking. I couldn't turn to very many other people and say they were on the same path as me in terms of improving.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just resonated with their content because what they were doing was fitness and helpful. And the many hours I put in walking on a treadmill to lose that first 40, 50 pounds was just to watch YouTube.
Wow.
And so it was like motivating and entertaining at the same time. But what's also cool is how now my journey has aligned with theirs on the entrepreneurial side. And I hadn't really recognized that of all of those guys that I look up to almost started with taking care of their physical health, which is what happened with me. And then you take ownership of one area of your life, and then it's like, good luck. If you get in much better shape than you were in the past, you quickly realize like you have more or less control over this world. And that is, it's a gateway drug to entrepreneurship is working out and just exercising and treating your body better. So those guys all inspired me. And now I think the guys you mentioned, they're like 30, 31, 32. So they're like 4 or 5 years ahead on their journey than I was. And I look back now thinking, when they were my age, what were they doing? How can I either learn from them, think about their potential mistakes, follow that similar path, that kind of thing. So I haven't done this yet, but like going back and watching those videos that shaped me when I was 21 and now seeing what they've done now, it's interesting to go back to that point on their journey. I think this is a bigger picture thing of looking at the people you look up to, but not comparing where you're at to where they are now. Compare where you're at to where they are on that step of the journey. Yes. And so find a way to say, hey, this person that I really look up to has done all these things. They didn't just happen, right? They were at some point on the journey as you are. And so how can you instead compare yourself to that versus the 10 steps ahead, especially on something that compounds like a business or something like that?
Yeah, like that's why I put out these podcasts raw, because I want somebody who's starting on episode 3 or episode 17 to be like, or episode 21 to be like, look, this is what it was at this point. And you could see how it improves. You could see how, so you're not getting a false expectation to your current reality. How does it hit you now that you are that for other people?
That's really cool to think about. I actually don't think about it that much, but
there's someone watching this right now who's like, I see Dickie and he's inspiring me to write. He's inspiring me to build a business. And right now they don't have anyone in their life, in their direct surroundings, who can be that person. But you are that person for them. How does that feel?
That feels really cool. Like straight up, that just feels really cool. If there's anyone, and there's a little bit of imposter syndrome where you say that out loud, I'm like, just no way. Right? And it's interesting to, because that's just where we came from, I think. Progress can happen so quickly where that certain parts of your mindset might not have caught up to, and I felt this definitely on the the fitness side, like I outpaced my mental improvement with my physical improvement, I think.
What do you mean? Break that down.
I think that there's like beliefs you have around being when you're 280 pounds that take just as much work to train yourself out of as it does to lose that much weight. But I might have put in more work on the physical fitness side than like the, there's nothing too tangible, but I think you have to recognize that you make progress in different areas of your life at different rates and recognize when potentially that progress might have outstripped another area. So I'll give you a couple of examples, but I do want to go back to this point. Like if you have a windfall of financial success, but your mental ability and relationship with money has not changed, that's why you see these guys that are millionaires who still like won't upgrade their flight ticket because they made a bunch of material progress without any of the mental progress of like, oh, I have enough money to live a little bit more comfortably, right? So back to the point before that, though, I think it's really cool to if there's someone watching this who's inspired. And my advice to them is make it a goal where you're writing that story now that someone is going to follow in the future, right? And so look at wherever you are at this point and say, I can't wait to build for the next 5 years because along the way, I'm crafting that story that is going to inspire someone else too. So that's the best thing I could do, right? Is inspire someone to take action that then inspires more people to take action. So very cool to think about.
The best sign of a leader is not how many followers they have. It's how many leaders they've created. And so you've created leaders by Ship 30. You've created leaders, people who are leading themselves now and building their own future. And that speaks to you as a leader. So, great work.
Thank you. I like that. That is, I never heard that. It's not about the number of followers you have. It's about the number of leaders you create. That's very cool to think about because there's the multiplicative impact of that. If you're creating more leaders, they're creating more leaders. You're having a much bigger impact than this one person who just has everyone following them. Huh?
Think about Christian Guzman, Matt Ogus. They created a leader in you. To lead yourself, lead your fitness yourself so that you could then build and create something new.
Very cool.
What's been the lesson that's taken you longest to learn?
Long-term thinking. Or operating with abundance. And so those were the two, I had 10 big lessons from the year. I published a 20,000 word annual review. Film like a 2-hour YouTube video.
1 hour, 45 minutes, yeah, linked below.
Right, there you go. Just because I had, so much had happened this year that I really thought it will be a pivotal year to look back on in 20 or 30. I was like, I'm going to do the work and really distill everything that happened this year. So the lesson it's not the lesson that has taken me the longest to learn. It's because I'm still learning it, but it's extending the time horizon with everything that I'm doing. And so really it's hard to operate with a long-term time horizon when every year of your life, especially from 21 to 26, so much changes that your ability to project is not very good, right? You're not able to say, I know I'm going to be doing this for a long time. And so I by no means look back on 21-year-old me and say, hey, think longer term, right? Because I think you have to think and operate aggressively in the short term to kind of make those leaps of progress. But I've gotten to a point now where I can look and finally talk in years versus I'm talking in weeks and days. So operating with a long-term time horizon, I'm still not it. So one of the lessons I put in there was wealth is a spectrum measured by wealth is a spectrum measured by the time horizon of your thinking. So the wealthiest person is able to think in decades. Like Jeff Bezos is not worried about what's happening next week. He's thinking about his legacy for the next five centuries versus the poorest person. They're not able to plan past their next meal, right? So wealth is the progressive lengthening of your time horizon, where as you accumulate more, you're able to say, okay, I'm at a place where I'm operating now longer term, right? Years, because I'm secure where I'm at. Now I can do that kind of planning. And so I think it's a very iterative process of sprinting, doing some kind of audit, like how long term can I think now? Can I think in 20 years? Probably not. I don't think I'm there yet, but I'm able to plan ship 30 for the next 1 to 3 years versus, hey, the next week. Or I'm able to say, I know that I'm going to be doing very similar things on the health and fitness front for 20 years. And if I do that, where am I going to be? A very good spot. All right, great. Now I know what to do today. So long-term thinking, operating with abundance, those two kind of things are lessons that I'm still in the process of learning.
When you say that, it reminds me that in order to think long-term, you have to know that you're going to be doing the thing in a long time, which means you generally have to like doing the thing or love doing the thing. You know you love writing, or at least love it and enjoy it enough to do it every day and know it's helpful to you. And so I think what happens a lot is you're 21 and you're like, I should be thinking long term. I should be but like you don't know what you actually like or what to commit yourself to for that long enough time horizon. So what's the advice then to that person?
Don't overthink it. Mm-hmm. And I think the most freeing long term belief of being 21 is recognize that you're going to get to explore a ton of different things, and that people talk about their 20s just like that. They say, in my 20s, right? I did one thing. They're like, oh, in my 20s, I did this. Like, I was a manager in my 20s. I'm like, that's 10 years. And people, when you talk to 50, 60, 70 year olds, they're like, they describe that decade as, I did this, right?
Yeah.
And so we get so caught up in, oh, I'm doing this. I got to do this. I got this. Look at this person. Look at that person. They're doing all these other things. And then you talk to anyone older, they're like, oh yeah, my 20s, I did this. And so my advice is recognize that future you looks at all the different things. And this is a lot of advice to myself. It's like all these little stresses that you have. It's like, oh yeah, in my 20s, I built a business and that was it. Like all the little end of the world, fire, whatever. It's like, this is a flash in the pan, you know? And so you got, again, extend the time horizon, recognize you're going to be doing this for a long time. You're going to be doing different things for a long time. And so don't get caught up of, I have to have my whole life figured out. I still don't, right? I might have it a little bit more figured out than I did 2 years ago, which is great, but no, it's an iterative game. You are always progressively thinking longer term, then short term, longer, short, longer, short, all the way.
Talk to me about the shipyard.
Ooh, this will be fun. So the shipyard just got a name to become the shipyard. For a long time, it was just this tonight idea in my head.
Oh, wow.
But the long story is, I think one of the coolest things to open up would be a co-working cafe, gym, mini hotel. And this is actually inspired by a lot of the fitness guys, Christian Guzman has
Alpha
done.
Alpha Land?
Yeah, that place is awesome.
Unbelievable.
Right?
Let's clip this up and send it to Christian
Guzman. Exactly, exactly. But he's had a big impact on it. And I look at, so there's a couple things on this. One, I think it'd be really cool to do, to have one place where people can come to work, they can work out, they can, there'll be like a reception area, hold events. I think having podcast studio, like where creative people could gather, where people aligned on this both health and fitness journey, creative journey, entrepreneurial, like that's a certain subset of people that I want to have a place where I know I'm surrounding myself with them in the real world. I've found ways to do that in the digital world. How can we do it in the real world? I also think that anytime I want to learn something, I try to find a project that guarantees I learn those skills by doing it. Mm-hmm. And so the shipyard, and this is, who knows how long in the future it is, but I know it's in the future, is going to force me to learn real estate. We're going to document the whole thing on YouTube when we eventually do it. So that's video production, you know, event, interior design, community building, right? Think of all the different skills that if I built this thing, I have to learn. And so to me, that's like the next logical step. As in the last 2 years, I've learned how to write. I've learned how to run an internet business. I've learned health and fitness, those kind of things. What are some new skills I want to learn? Real estate. Operating like an in-person physical space, not just digital business, right? Physical, what would that look like? So it's a way of learning new skills, having a lot of fun doing it, and hopefully just building something really cool that is beyond me or ship, whatever. It's like a cool idea. I'm still fleshing this out clearly, but it's been an idea in my head, and it clicked to me, I don't know, 6 months ago, that I'm not that far away from being able to do that. And that was really cool because I think I told people about the compound. It used to just be in my head, the compound, right? And I remember telling people in college or like right out of college that, and there was just no clear path of how that was going to happen. Working on Wall Street, sitting there like, oh, that would be cool. It's like, yeah, of course that'd be cool, but like, you're just not going to do that if you're here, right? And so I was always like, there was a mismatch long term. So then it kind of hit me a couple months ago, like, oh, I could start that process tomorrow. I don't think we will, but could, which is almost as cool as having the real thing. It's like, oh, I could go do that, right? But not chasing every shiny object, pursuing every opportunity.
If you had to pick three people to be representatives of the shipyard and be like, this is the ideal person or one of the ideal people that I would like to be there and every day, and that when people think of the shipyard, they think of this type of person or this specific person. Which three people come to mind? And they don't have to necessarily be in their 20s or what, they could be older people, they could be younger, whatever.
I don't think I can give a perfect answer of exactly who, but I know the type of person that I think I'd want to attract there. And it would be someone who is interested in building some kind of business on their own that they're able to operate from relatively anywhere, right? So it's like that digital first, but also prioritizing some kind of in-person thing. I think they're going to be interested in living a high quality, high energy lifestyle, which is why the cafe would be super, you know, based, grass fed, all that kind of stuff, high quality, organic coffee, all of that. The gym will obviously be world-class, top notch, all this cool, you know, I just think it's the ideal person is someone who likes the things that I really like, which are those, right? So it's a very clear filter of if you're interested in taking care of yourself and building a business, you're going to fit in very well here, right? Versus if those aren't your things, there's tons of other communities. And I think the idea of crafting, like you go look at Anatomy or Equinox or all these other places that have built fitness first communities, I think it's a cool exercise of thinking about the type of values you want to communicate through that. I think the type of person that would or would not, like the demographic of a Planet Fitness versus Equinox versus Anatomy versus Gold's Gym, right? All those are in the same area, but they all appeal to a different person. And so how can you create something where from the beginning you go, this is the type of person I want to attract. Let's build everything around that.
How much of that is bottom up versus top down? Like how much of the Ship 30 ecosystem or community was something that you set out to achieve versus it happening organically?
100% organically. If you'd have told me 2 years ago that Ship 30, my goal with Ship 30 was to have a side hustle that generated $10,000 in a year. Because to me, I was like, an extra $1,000 a month, that's amazing. Like, that's it.
The biggest things start small.
Right. And so I had 900 followers at the time. And all it was a Slack accountability community that helped people build a writing habit. Everything, like the original cohort, was $50 and you got your money back if you completed all 30 days because I was so terrified to charge money. So I'm like charging back people on PayPal, like keeping a spreadsheet. People are like, I missed one day. Can I have my money back? I'm like, yes, of course. Like, I'm so sorry. I charged you for this. Right. So yes, it's been 100% bottoms up and it's just iterated cohort after cohort and continues to as well. So I think that the eventual like lead in of the type of person that joined Ship 30 would be the type of natural person who has a physical space that they could come visit to. So
makes sense. You spoke before about how you were once that person at BlackRock who was sitting there and was like, I know I want to do something like, I know I'm bigger than this, or I know I'm dreaming bigger than this. But in that moment, you weren't doing that. You weren't doing things that on the surface could map to that reality. What do you tell that person today? And how does that person take the first step to change their life?
It all clicked for me. So backing up a smidge, I studied math at Princeton. It was a absolute dream job for me to go work as a hedge fund trader at BlackRock. Like dream job. The only job I've ever had. I was an intern there going into my junior year and senior year of college. The only job interview I've ever had, right? So to be there a year in, I loved my team. I loved the things I was doing. And for all 4 years there, I genuinely woke up excited to do those things. But I knew that that excitement was only going to lead somewhere where I potentially didn't want to be. So I've told this story a few times, but seeing someone on my floor ask their boss for permission to go to their son's Little League game. And this guy was probably in his early 30s. And I saw that and immediately clicked of that is potentially where this leads. That is absolute worst case scenario.
And the boss rejected him and said, you cannot go to the Little League game. And you're like, what?
And so I put myself in that shoes of, why am I doing any of this? And this goes back to the foundational fatherhood thing. So instead of going home the next day and quitting, I said, okay, let's be rational about this. I don't think I'm doing this for 50 years. And that's a good realization to have as quickly as I could. But that doesn't mean I'm not going to do this for the next four. How can I find a way to passively pursue opportunities without necessarily giving up what I'm doing now? And the answer to that is just to write on the internet, is to put your ideas out there, because it's how we met. It's how 95% of the people that I talk to on a daily basis I met. It was they read something that I put out there and became interested in me, and we became friends. And so that's just how opportunities find you. You become easy to find. And so the piece of advice is figure out a way where you can passively explore those and not people go, oh, it had to be such a risk to leave Black, like all this. I'm like, it was a risk to stay there any longer because I was about as conservative as you could get, both financially and mentally, of like, am I ready to do this? Am I ready to do this? Whatever.
I remember talking to you in those days.
Yeah, man. And it's only been 9 months. So I was working there until March of 22.
Feels like years ago personally. And I'm sure for you, it must be a very weird feeling.
I mean, that's why I wrote that blog post and made that video, because that marked a very big transition in my life of working for someone else versus definitely the last time I will ever work for someone else. So back to the piece of advice, it's figure out just some small ways to passively pursue things and let new opportunities potentially find you. And you'd be very surprised what can happen in a year of doing that.
Yeah. Do you have a schedule that you recommend or would recommend someone take? And let's say I'm sure you've given this advice for Twitter specifically, but like, let's say someone is into YouTube or they're into TikTok or they're into Instagram. Like that's where they consume and that's where they want to create. Like what do you tell that person and what type of schedule would you explain or suggest to that person?
I would say one thing per day, every day for a year.
Yeah.
And if you stick to that, if you stick to one thing per day, every day for a year, no matter what medium you're on, you are going to get so much better, so much faster than anyone who, because when I first started, I wrote weekly blog posts and no one read them except my mom. And I didn't have any feedback loop. And so half a year in, I'd created 25 things and I wasn't any better. But everything accelerated for me when I went, instead of writing a weekly thing, I'm going to write a daily thing. And more importantly, I'm not going to write that on my blog. I'm going to write it on Twitter, where there's a natural feed of attention where I can get feedback on these ideas. And so the playbook is put something out in public that you can get ruthless feedback on right away. And in the beginning, there's going to be almost no feedback. And that's okay. Relish in that time, because that means no one is reading it. You have a chance to just explore. Like, I look back on anything I put out now, guarantees has tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of eyeballs on it.
That's wild.
Right? Versus right when I started, I could talk about anything. I still can today, but I could test ideas very, very quickly, very, very easily. And now there's slightly less ability to do that. So you look back on that beginning part of your journey and say, I'm just going to explore. And I'm going to explore every single day. And that amount of volume that you do, you're going to get so much better, so much faster, just in that first 20, 30 days.
Yeah.
And then you're going to look back and say, okay, I can definitely stick to this for a year. But actually, I got so much signal on talking about this topic that I'm going to expand over here. Right? You're just tightening your feedback loops. That's all you're trying to do, especially in the beginning.
What's the biggest difference between posting and there's guaranteed tens of thousands of people who are going to see your thing versus posting and 1,000 people are going to see your thing?
I don't think too much. I really don't.
Hasn't been much of a difference.
No, because I'm still talking about the same things that I still talk about journaling questions, right? And for when I had 100 followers, I was tweeting a daily journaling question.
Yeah.
Right? There's not that much of a difference. I think you just, I know what people are interested in at this point because of how much volume I put in to get to where I am now.
You have more data.
Right. Exactly. I've proven feedback loops where if I go talk about this thing, I know people are going to be interested in it. I know it's going to be helpful. Right. So I think the biggest difference is the level of experience that is required to get to 100,000 versus 1,000 just proves you're just better at that point. And so it's easier to then repeat the process of what works.
When you think about the next year, we're recording this in January 2023. When you look at the end of 2023 and say, all right, this was a successful year, what are the key things that you want to point to and say, all right, I did this?
This year is about doing the basics, the boring basics, and doing them better. Mm-hmm. And that means relentless focus on the things we're already doing as a company. And as with my health and with everything I'm building, I will be proud at the end of this year if I just stuck to those things. And that goes back to the long-term thinking of like, what does a year look like that doesn't have revolutionary lifestyle change of working for a company versus living on my own versus building? Like, what does it look like to repeat the things that I know I should do and know need to be done, that boring, monotonous work that comes with improving a system, improving anything? What does it look like to just stick to that for an entire year and not chase the thousands of shiny objects and other opportunities that I could? And so really focusing on honing my attention on those basic, boring improvements and do that for a year and see what happens.
So on the health plan of it, you have your 2023 health plan. I want to read it out for people so they get a sense. Yoga 2 times per week, lifts 4 times per week, runs 10 miles every day, steps 15,000, sleep 9:30 to 5, caffeine, double espresso, mindfulness, 3 minutes before meals, nutrition, 3,000 calories, 200 grams of protein. This all sounds like stuff people know they should do, right? Mm-hmm. But I think it's worth pointing out, like, this is the Dickie Bush health system in 2023. And I could very much imagine that being a very similar system in 2033.
That point right there at the end is the most important part, where over the last 5 years, losing 100 pounds, I knew that what I was doing was not what I was going to do forever. So I actually couldn't think long term. It was like, once I get here, then I can do this. And in the last year, reaching that point, now I can say that exact plan I kind of want to do for the next 20 years. And if I know that if I'm doing that, I'm going to be 46 years old in damn good shape.
Yeah.
That has been what feels the best to me of, wow, I know what I'm doing today. I could repeatedly do for a long time, and that's going to generate results just by doing it. And I think everyone wants to get to that position where you know not only that you can do the things, or you know the things you should be doing, and you're actually doing them, right? We, Cole and I have a little bit of a framework on this where you, I don't know if I remember it perfectly, but you can basically be at four different points on kind of your improvement journey. The very beginning, you can be, I don't know what I should be doing and I'm not doing good things, right? That's like level zero. You have no clue what you should be doing and you're not doing anything really good. Level two is, I know what I should be doing and I'm not doing it. So it's not a knowledge gap, but it's a motivation gap, right? You know the things, and I think most people sit there. They sit, I probably should be moving more, eating less, whatever it is, writing, whatever. And then level three is, I know the things I should be doing and I'm doing them. And then level four is just repeating level three for a long, long, long time and not getting absolutely overwhelmingly
bored
with the level of monotony that comes with doing anything great. And so you can look at where you're at. And I think right now I'm on level 3.5 because there's still plenty of things that I know I should be doing that maybe I'm not. But for the most part, I feel like I have plans that I could stick to for a long time. And now the hardest part of all, ironically, the hardest part of all four is that when you get to that fourth stage, recognizing like, oh, this is it. Like, this is actually what I just have to do all the time. And that is mentally hard because for what got you to that point was trying different things. Mm. And so it's almost like you have to untrain yourself. And this goes with fitness, business, like relationships, everything comes on those four steps. And then the hard part is doing the mental, emotional work at the end of like, all right, I got to stick with this for a bit. And that's much harder.
Well, I think on that third stage is where confidence comes, because what you're doing on the day to day is in alignment with the person you want to be. And so when I talk to you, I feel a deep sense of confidence. And it's because I know you're just doing the actions that you're proud of, and the person you want to be in 10 years, 20 years is happy that you're doing those actions too.
Mm. I hope he is. I hope he's looking back like, not you, idiot, you were doing all of that, those things wrong. And he probably is, and I'll probably figure that out in the next couple of years, you know, all the things I'm still doing wrong. But I like that.
What you mentioned, the Sedona trip, the trip to Arizona, you went, it was the end of the year review, and you went 7 days without a phone. What was that like? What was the process you went through, and how could someone recreate that themselves if they want to?
So I went to Sedona. I'd never been to Arizona. I went with a buddy of mine who I grew up with, good friend, similar goals as me, similar worldview, that kind of thing. And I knew from the very beginning that the year was going to be very busy up until Black Friday. Black Friday ends. I had that trip on the calendar. I knew holiday season was going to be extremely busy. So in August, September, I looked and I was like, I know that the amount of growth I've had this year, I need some time to think about. And I looked at that like calendar and I said, I got all November, which is a lot of work. And then most of the holidays is either family or work. There's like 1 week, and it's the week after Thanksgiving where, like, I think all entrepreneurs should rest. It should be like a global retreat because
entrepreneurs,
right? Because your calendar is dictated around Black Friday, more than likely you're running some kind of promotion. And then the end of the year, you might be running something too, and you have family and all that. So it's like your 1 week where you could be kind of unreachable, there's a quiet time, is like that first week in December. And so that trip, I went, I turned my phone off when I got there. I was without it for 7 days. I just had a physical stack of journals and I just started reading. And I said, my goal by the end of this was to have a recap of all the things that went well, all the things that I think I could improve, and try to distill some lessons and realizations that I want to take forward and write about and think about, and then finish with what am I most excited about building for the year ahead. And so I just followed that process. And it was very interesting to wake up. My days were very simple. I'd wake up, go for a walk, sit down, read those for like 7 hours until I couldn't really think much more. And then I'd go hike and explore the Red Rock Canyons and then come back, eat dinner, and do it again. And it was awesome. And it was the most productive for... So it was 5 days in total. I wish I would have stayed longer, could have stayed longer, because there's like, you kind of hit that stride, you know, 4 or 5 days in. But it was fine. I got everything I needed done. And so to recreate it yourself, look, I always preface the things I say now is that I'm very lucky to be a 26-year-old with no external responsibilities, that I can take a week off. So I don't ever look here and say, you know, you just got to book a week in Arizona and not talk to anyone for a week. That's how you solve a lot of, if you want some reflection, right? Because that's just unrealistic. But we created a yearly review guide. I think it's theyearlyreview.com, and it's not too late to go do that. But it basically walks through that process of figuring out what went well, what could be improved, what you learned, and then just distilling that, because I know that in 20 years, I can't wait to read each of my annual reviews and getting those up, because I've been doing them for 2 or 3 years now, but I'd never written and published them publicly. Oh. So to put that one out this year, I was like, this is my stake in the ground that I'm going to do this for the next 20. Let's get the most pivotal year of my life out with one and then go from there.
Dude, to think how helpful that's going to be to people reviewing the journey, that when they see what you've built over the next 10 years and then be able to go back to the first one that they could see. Really valuable. When you look at those 5 days and you went away, I did this too in 2020. I need to do it again. But the day 4 and 5, I felt such clarity. And because of the clarity, I felt such optimism of a perfect sense of what I was supposed to do next. Mm. It was a perfect understanding of, okay, I've been doing all these things and these are the things that I want to focus in. And that's how this podcast started. Mm. The single best decision of my life was to create this podcast, and it only happened because I went away for 5 days and just thought and read old journals. So my question is, like, did you also have a sense of optimism and excitement that happened right in those day four, day five window?
100%. Like, right, I was ready to leave because I knew what I needed to do.
Yeah.
I knew the path I needed to take, and I knew the steps that I wanted. The upside of starting with ending with what I'm most excited for, I listed those out. I was like, oh my gosh, I can't wait to go back and get back to what I was doing. So yes, exactly. I felt that right around day four, day five of maybe I could have gone a little bit longer and had a little bit more clarity, but I was ready to go.
Was there anything that you were surprised to learn about yourself from reviewing all those journal entries?
Not as much surprising as just, damn, a lot happened this year. I was sitting there and it was December and I'd only been out of my corporate job for 8 months. I think I had about 10 years of personal growth in 8 months. Yes. And that's exactly how it felt. And so as I was reading those, reading the 10, 20 pages I wrote of the pros and cons of leaving, like starting that because I made that decision in January, like revisiting that and thinking, wow, that felt like the, and still to this day, the biggest decision I've ever made. And to have that there and start with that, I was like, that was the beginning of the year. All these different things that have happened since then. It was more alarming of, wow, a lot can happen. I'm so glad I journaled throughout the year. Like that, I think was my biggest takeaway, was like how many of these things that I knew I was going to come back and kind of think about later, I'm so grateful that I had these in physical form.
How do you recommend people get started with journaling? What are the few steps that they can take?
It's one sentence per day. Just summarize the day. That's it.
But Dickie, that's not going to be effective. I'm not going to learn about my day if I do that.
Yeah, you won't. But you'll never do that unless you start very small, very easily, right? And so this is with my meditation habit. I'm trying to practice what I preach right now of I know that I want to explore a bunch of different ways, meditating, different styles, different tempos, different formats. But like for a month, I just wanted to do for 3 minutes. And if I can do that, then I have a foundation. So you're never going to get to that higher level. And it's a very difficult skill to think about hierarchies of habits or hierarchies of anything new. And I'm still trying to work on this, but it's like, most people want to jump to level 7. Like, I'd love to be able to sit for 2 hours and meditate like very perfectly, but I know that the foundation is showing up, right? And I don't want to just parrot James Clear on how to build habits. Like, Atomic Habits says this whole thing, but that's what you have to do. You master the art of showing up and you start with that. How easy would it be to expand a journaling habit that you've done for a month with a single sentence, right? Versus starting from now, I got to write a page every night. It's just unrealistic.
I love James Clear's advice, but I want to push back because I think that there's doing 3 minutes of meditation a day is helpful for some people. But what if I was like, all right, do a push-up a day and you don't see any progress after 30 days? And you're like, well, I'm the type of person who does one push-up a day now, but I don't see the growth. Whereas if you had done 4 sets of 10, then you would see growth at the end of the month and you'd be like more inclined to actually continue doing it. What's the response to that?
How many people would be able to do 4 sets of growth of push-ups for a month versus how many people could do one? So I think the goal is to get as many people to do one, knowing that most people cannot do 4. And you think that the tangible level of growth will be like, my chest is bigger, I'm stronger. But to them, it might just be that they prove to themselves that they could do one thing every day for a month. And so it's starting like a level lower almost, right? Of you, how do I simply become a person who sticks to what they're going to say, tells the truth to themselves? And then once I know that, I know, okay, if I'm the type of accountable person who does what they say they're going to do, now I can say I'll do 10. And I know that when I set that, I'm living up to some new identity that I've established by doing one.
Yeah. So my response to you is, I know you're an accountable person, or at least I believe that. So if you know that you are, if you do something and you say you're going to do it, then why not set the bar higher so that when you actually do the activity, you're going to actually feel the result of doing it? Which you might end up doing if you do 20 minutes or 15 minutes rather than 3 minutes.
I think as much as I want to 100% believe I'm an accountable person, I might prove myself wrong if I start too hard. So why not lay the bar a little bit lower where it's like, I know I can live up to that identity pretty easily. And then go from there rather than, hey, I'm forced to confront a difficult identity every day, which might be better. But again, I'm going back to extend the time horizon. Like, if I'm going to be meditating for 20 years, it's okay if I spend 6 months doing 3 minutes.
Yeah.
Right? Because I'm going to look back on that time and be like, I'm very glad I took it slow and built it that way.
Yeah. You have a great quote here that I pointed out from one podcast you did, which really hit me. It was, most people don't understand that maintenance requires far less effort than they think, but growth takes way more. Just never heard it put like that.
I'm not sure. I think I got that from Alex Hormozzi. But it's this idea that maintenance, and I definitely got it from him as I think about this, and he has a great way of thinking of maintenance. Because when you do fitness, you start to recognize that at a certain level, maintaining where you're at is not very difficult. And most people live their life in this middle ground where they're not doing enough to grow, but they're doing way too much to stay the same on all areas of life. And so this was one of my big realizations of the year is I need to be more thoughtful about the areas I'm looking to maintain, and I'm spending too many resources to maintain that level, and then redirect those to the areas I'm trying to grow, which likely takes way more effort than I'm doing. And the best way to think about this is maintaining $1 billion and $1,000 takes the same level of effort because you put it in a bank account.
Wow.
Right? To maintain that level of wealth, growing at 3%, same level of effort. Getting to $1 billion versus getting to $1,000, way different levels of effort, right? Bodybuilder, person in horrible shape. To maintain their level of fitness, they just do the same things they've been doing for the last year to get there, right? And so this person to get to where he was and this person to get to where they are doing the same kind of consistent habits that they're clearly able to continue doing. But to get to that level of bodybuilder takes an absurd amount of effort. And so I think I'm trying to keep this top of mind of whatever game I end up playing, am I trying to grow or am I trying to maintain? And I don't want to sit in that middle ground. And so I want to apply maximum force to those areas I want to grow. And then everything else be like, I'm on maintenance mode. What is the minimum amount I can do to maintain there? Let's do that. And that, this sounds great. And it's so much harder to actually implement. But yeah.
What game or games are you currently playing?
I think I'm playing building an internet business, growing a community-based education and software business, and writing as a way to generate interest in those businesses and in the other things I'm doing. I think those are my games at the moment. And maybe I count health and fitness and improving that as a game. And those are my big things. And I think that the business one goes back to the financial game, right? The byproduct of helping a ton of people is you get some of that value exchanged, right? In the form of money, right? So it builds the financial system or financial foundation, health foundation. And I think those are the games I'm currently playing.
How should people go about figuring the games that they want to win at?
You got to just play. You got to play a bunch of games. I've played a lot of games in my life. Like that essay, maybe we can link to it, of the different obsessions I've had. I've played a lot of games. And so I know what it's like to start something new. I know what it's like to get good at a game. I know what it's like to quit a game. And so if you don't know which games to play, you just need to start playing them. Mm-hmm. You need to go figure out what's the easiest way I can start doing this thing and see what it's like. And I hate to just keep coming back to this long time horizon, but if you understand that you're going to play a ton of different games, then it makes sense to just start playing them, right? Because you could do 6 months on this one and realize that it's not the game for you. And worst case, you lost out on 6 months, right? And then find a new one.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to go through your framework for content because when I heard you say it, it was obvious, but I hadn't considered it before you had said it. And I was like, oh my God, this is so good. I got to write this down. Mm. So I hope that I can say it so that more people can hear it and it could impact people, like really helping. But your framework for content is 6 things. 1, what problem am I solving? 2, whose problem am I solving? 3, what benefits am I unlocking? 4, what promise am I making? 5, what emotion am I generating? And 6, what's the next action my reader should take? I think this is super helpful for anyone who is putting out a podcast, putting out a YouTube, putting out Twitter, whatever it is that you're trying to grow a business. It's like, if you ask yourself those 6 questions, the thing that you're putting out will be better because of it.
Those questions sit at the top of everything I write.
Wow.
The first 6 questions, anytime I pop open something to start writing about it, I have a keyboard shortcut that posts those 6. Because if you look very closely, where I think a lot of people go wrong when they're creating is they create from a place of ego of here's what I'm interested in. People are going to be interested in me. Me, me, me. Here's what I'm doing. Hey, reader, exchange time from your life to read this thing I wrote. versus every single one of those is an empathetic question. What problem am I solving? Whose problem am I solving? It all starts with that. Anything you're creating is solving some kind of problem. And if you are not creating from that way, you're creating from a place of ego, right? If it's, I'm just going to live my life and film it. Sure, that could work for some people who do that at the absolute highest level. But the truth is, most people come to you because you're solving a problem for them. And so if you can't answer those two questions with the things you're creating, it's probably why it's not resonating with people, right? And then the second two are benefits unlocking and
promise I'm making,
right? So anything you're creating, it's what promise am I making? So if you do these things or if you take this action or whatever, here's where you're headed. And then that allows you to unlock some kind of benefit. And if once you start to distill that, it's, okay, I'm solving a problem for someone so that they can unlock this thing. And I'm communicating in a way that all the other things they potentially tried in the past might not have worked. Here's what is going to work this time. So I'm making some kind of promise. Emotion I'm generating is, I got this one from Sean Puri, and there's, you can take the same content and deliver it in a different way, right? And so I like to just say, do I want the reader to go, oh, wow, or do I want the reader to go, to laugh, or do I want the reader to go, that's extremely interesting, I've never seen it that way, right? So you just want to list those ways of thinking of like, do I want them to be intrigued? Do I want them to be surprised, right? Once you put those words out, you'll recognize that what you're writing or creating kind of tailors to that. And then the last one is just from the copywriting world of like, send the reader on their way every single time, whether that's if you're on YouTube, hey, if you like this video, watch this video. If you like this thread, you'll like this thread. People want to be given more if they're at the end of whatever it is that you just created, right? So I think people get to they'll write something or create something and then get to the end and be like, I don't want to sell them on something else, or I don't want to take their, but think about the type of person who got to the end of whatever it is and didn't leave and go back to TikTok. They're clearly interested in what you're doing. So why not give them more resources for them to go down the rabbit hole? So I think it's a slight limiting belief some people have of, I don't want to tell my reader what to do. Tell my watcher, go watch this, right? But instead think of it, that empathetic lens, you just solved a big problem for them. They're feeling great. They want more problems solved. Show them more ways to do it.
That's why I end every one of these podcasts with a challenge, because the challenge points to the place, the action that you can take. You listen to a full podcast episode, You can then go do something in your life. You can then create something. You can then lead your own life in a new way so that it could have an additional benefit and an additional way to help. And so we'll come back to that very shortly. But before we do, I want to ask about when you look at people building things in the world, and especially on the internet, what do you see when you look at the landscape and you're like, most people get this wrong. What is that thing or those things where you wish more people would just do this differently and they're building on the internet?
That's a great question. What jumps to mind is specificity. Where I think that the biggest... This is both what I wish people do and what I think most people get wrong, is that they're worried about potentially cutting out a customer, a reader, a watcher, et cetera. And they try to create something for everyone. And so the byproduct is they create something for no one. And so if you look at Ship 30, this is not the world's best writing course for you to write a book. You can write a screenplay. You can write whatever it is you want to write. No, it's to help you start writing online. If the only people interested in that are people who want to start are not currently doing so, right? And you look at the specificity of that and people go, that's so small. Like, I want to talk about writing. How are you going to limit yourself in that way? And then every time you add a level of specificity, you recognize that there's so much more to go. The market of people who want to start writing is by definition smaller than the total world of writing. But think about that market is anyone who's not currently started. So it, by getting more specific, it kind of gives clarity to who it's for. And I think that that's the number one, it goes back to those questions, right? How can you get more specific with who you're solving a problem for and what the actual problem is? And so figure out which lever you could talk about by price or by industry or by demographic or by level of experience, right? All these different levers you can push up and pull down. We talk about seven of them in Ship 30. I named four. I think location's another one. Like you could say this person, but in Miami, or this person, but in New York, or industry, you know, leadership for SaaS founders or leadership for podcasters. You figure out how you can take whatever topic or problem you want to solve, product you want to create, whatever it is, and say, how can I start with a smaller audience? Because that forces people to make a choice of whether or not they're in that small audience or not. And once you do that, you unlock the people who are. So look at Uber. Uber started as a luxury taxi service for people in San Francisco. That was it. It wasn't world world mobility platform. It was one thing for one specific type of person, and that's how it started. And you look at a lot of other companies, they're very similar in that. So figure out how I can solve a more specific problem for a more specific person. Start with there and get over the uncomfortable feeling of that means there are fewer potential people, right? Only 6,000 people have taken Ship 30. So as much as I feel like we've cut out a lot of people by only going at start, there's way more than 6,000. So like you, if you think that by adding specificity, you're just, the market's too small, you'll prove yourself wrong the second you do that, because you'll actually start to get inbound on whatever it is you created.
Yeah. And the market for people for Ship 30 is incredibly high, and hopefully we get to
billions.
Actually, and we're on a mission for a million. And
on a mission for a million, because you look at the byproduct of that mission, it means a million people have started to distill their expertise for the people who want to learn from them, or for people ahead of them. You know, the amount of knowledge, information, opportunity, and just general positive things that would come from a million people starting to put their ideas out there is what excites me about waking up right now, because I just look at the long-term implications of a million more people, which is not even that many when you think about the total number of people who could start writing is anyone who hasn't, which is billions, billions of people who have unique life experiences that they could be sharing for other people. And they're experts in something that is so specific that the internet has now enabled you to build an entire business or life or anything around that for every year before the last 20, millions, billions, whatever, that's not been true. But now you can get extremely specific about one thing and build an entire life around it. And if we can help a million people do that, I think it'd be pretty cool.
We are living in a magical world, and you're helping make that a reality. Like I said before, I like to end these podcasts with a challenge for people. A challenge points to the place in your heart you feel this conversation could help people take action from the things they listened to or watched and build into their life. What's a challenge we can leave people with to create the best version of themselves?
Figure out where your wants are and kill them. And so what I mean by that is, if you're listening to this or watching this right now, there's probably some area of your life where you feel like once this happens, then I'll take the next step to this thing. So once work slows down, then I'll start that business. Or once my kid gets to 3 years old, then I'll have more time. And once you identify where you're looking, you know, the things you're looking at in your life that you're saying, once I this, then I'll get there, kill your onces and just start that thing right now. Because the truth is, there will never be a right time to start anything. For some reason, we always assume that we're going to be less busy in the future, or that when that thing dies down, for some reason, there's not going to be another thing for us to put it off for. And most people live their whole life with those onces compounding once and once and once and time again. And they look up 40 years later and it's once has turned into their whole lifetime, right? So if you're watching this, listening to this, find one once in your life, kill that and start that thing today.
Dickie, you are a really special person. I'm really grateful to have known you. I'm really grateful to have witnessed the journey start and watch it unfold to this magical place today. I'm really honored to be here and sit down with you. You continue to inspire me, and I'm really grateful to call you a friend. Thank you for doing this, and where should we send people to connect with you further?
Well, man, this is one thing I know for sure is this might be the third, but it'll be the third of 20.
Yeah.
Because as you continue this journey, which has been so incredible to see your improvement, the big name guests you've had, this, I mean, we're in a studio. We were on Skype on the first one. I remember having to make a Skype account. I was like, I haven't used Skype since middle school, you know? And I know that you're going to be doing this for a long time, and I'm extremely grateful to be a single or double or triple digit episode, because when you get into the 10,000s of them, right, which I know you'll be doing, we're going to look back on these, and it's going to be cool. So I appreciate you having me. It's always a blast. I'm so glad we got to do this in person.
Yeah.
In-person podcasting. I'm a big fan. This is the first one I've ever done.
Wow.
And so I'm already looking at this space and thinking, how can Cole and I start to do something here? Because it's just a cool vibe. Like, yeah. It's a little bit more fun. So people can find me on Twitter at Dickie Bush, LinkedIn. If you want to start writing, the best place to go is startwritingonline.com. You can download our 13,000 word ultimate guide. It's got kind of everything you need to start writing, frameworks, platforms, Twitter, LinkedIn, idea generation, headlines, all that. It's all free. It's all there. So that's the best place to go down the rabbit hole if you're looking to start writing.
Twitter, LinkedIn, startwritingonline.com, linked below. Dickie Bush, thank you so much, man.
Boom. Thanks for having me.